Well, it might not be out there tonight. It's down there because our guest is John Rhodes. We're talking about reptoids, where they may live. We'll get into that in a moment. I'm also going to find out from John a little more description of their physical form, because you're going to find it to be very fascinating in terms of what these creatures look like. And welcome back Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, John Rhodes, I guess. John, let's talk a little bit more about their physical form and then get into where they may be. Now, they are very close to humans in that they have, what, two arms, two legs, a head?
The general form as a human being does, two arms, two legs, a head, eyes in the same place, face generally looking the same. Some of the structures differ in the face. For example, you wouldn't see any eyebrows on these creatures or eyelashes. There are no lips. It's pretty much little scutes or scales that are wrapped tightly around a ridge that forms a line across their mouth. No ears, perhaps a small scale or flap actually laying right alongside the skull. Eyes that are almond-shaped and wrap around the sides a little bit of their head.
Mm-hmm.
Pupils that have vertical slits in them, often referred to historically as the flame-like pupils. They also have, they're very broad-chested. These are the general reptoids that we're talking about, the ones that people have seen most. Broad-chested, strong arms, very lean bodies. For the males, they've been seen actually wearing outfits, perhaps trying to disguise themselves as humans at a distance.
Interesting.
Otherwise, they have actually been seen without any clothes on, and with the males, you can't see any outside genitalia because it's wrapped within a cloaca, which is a sac. It's like a pouch. And
how about digits on hands and feet?
Digits, you got three digits with an opposable thumb. The nails are usually more toward like a dog's than anything that's been popularly described as long and sharp and hooked, and that just sounds really scary. But for the most part, we've come down to seeing the patterns revealed that they're more of a dog-like claw. Their feet also are like regular human feet. However, they've got a fourth. Kind of like a thumb or a digit that's wrapped around halfway back up their ankle that's on the opposite side. So we're talking about beings that are physically imposing. We're also talking about some of them have been seen to be quite wild and reported as being more animal-like than anything. The chupacabra is an example of that. People say that they see scales on this creature, but at the same time, hair-like structures. Well, if you study anything about keratin and how even hair came about in the mammal world, you'll discover that it's all from the same keratin growth, and that eventually over time it elongated from a scale out to a long structure of hair that was hollow and allowed for more thermal protection against the body. So we're talking about it's hair and scales are not so different as people would really think. So some of these creatures have looked like they've been hairy. Some of them have actually quills. Some have been seen with quills under their chin, which reported looking like they had a beard. And then there are the Draco, of course, which I mentioned before. These are brownish green beings with the same physical construct as one of the regular reptoids that I just described. However, they have large wings on their backs that are made of a leathery-like skin. And sometimes when people have seen them at a distance, they look like clothes.
There was an old
over their shoulders.
There was a movie with Dennis Quaid that, and I think they called the reptilian alien a Drac or something like that.
Drac from Draco.
Drake, that's right, exactly.
And of course, you know, all of this is historical context, which television shows like Stargate has used to promote the entire philosophy of their show, this evil reptilian thing, and. As you can see in modern media now, we've been inundated with the dragon images from Steven Spielberg and all these guys, And now we're seeing an emergence of humanoid reptilian characters coming up in science fiction and films. As a matter of fact, NBC is getting ready to remake V into a 2 or 3 hour miniseries.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
It's just been tagged. So that's why I'm saying everybody's got to understand that this is the next step in the human awareness of what exactly is going on in this planet.
Why are all the reptilians in the media presented as evil?
Well, it's because it's actually using 2,000 years of indoctrination. So something's already been set in its path to help them do it, to help people produce fear. And, you know, fear promotes things to be sold. Everybody loves to be scared. They go to the movie theaters all the time.
Sure. That's also why, control.
Right. And that's why people who present these beings as nothing but, I mean, they'll have perhaps one or two detractors that say, I mean, not detractors, but they'll have one or two lines in a presentation that says they're not all bad, but the only ones that are concentrated on and being presented to the public are being told that they're manipulative, they're in charge of our leaders, they're doing this, that, and the other. And to me, it seems to me that if there is really a global neighborhood out there of other species that are living underground, and we want to be part of that neighborhood, then I would think that as wise as they might be by now, they may be expecting us one day to wake up and take responsibility for the ills of our own planet instead of trying to brush them off on some unseen creatures that somebody is saying is, you know, it's a witch hunt beginning.
Well, going back to Byrd, Admiral Byrd, again, one of the reasons why they wanted to talk to him, if they did, was because they were concerned about what we were doing to the planet.
Right, because why would something off our planet be so concerned about our planet? If they had a hands-off policy, that would mean that they wouldn't be concerned about the planet. But it seems to me that every time, you know, we hear about abductions and such like that, the real cases, that 4 to 5% of cases that just can't be rocked, you always have these people coming away feeling a little bit more eco-sensitive. And it seems to me that if they're from this planet and there's a trickle-down, in other words, if we destroy the surface and start a chain collapse, it's going to affect the food chain.
Well, tell me, though, what under what auspices did a lot of these people who have given the information to allow you to describe what they look like, under what auspices did they come in contact with these reptoids?
There have been many cases in which people in the privacy of their own bedroom have actually entertained a contact. And I say entertained a contact because it's difficult to tell because of human psychology. This is the great thing about, and I hope you discuss it on tomorrow's show, is the root of human consciousness is seated in the ancient part of our brain. This part of our brain is neuroanatomist Paul McLean, who is a very important person in the scientific circles in the government, had said that it was the reptilian part of our brain. I think you've heard David pick up on this. I mean, years ago I had been talking about it, and it's become more and more known about. The ancient part of our brain, if you look back on how we develop from the fetus and we go through these ontological stages where we reproduce kind of like an evolutionary movie, basically, in the womb. And we even have a tail at one point. We have gill clefts like a fish. We have all these things. And later on, we lose these before we're born. Sometimes we don't entirely lose them. That's why people are born with a caudal appendage, which is actually an extension of your backbone into a tail. There have been cases in which people in third world countries who cannot afford the risk or the money to have these surgically removed at birth are seen as tribal totems, and they don't show them to outsiders because the outsiders would freak out. But some of these people are walking around with tails, and some of them actually have hair on them, and they have been known to actually, when a person gets excited, that tail does involuntarily move, just like a dog would. Now, that sounds so strange, but you know what? I think it's been said, you know, there's greater strangeness in truth than there are in any fantasy, you know, because we're talking about something that's a biological fact. Human beings sometimes are born with a skin condition called ichthyo vulgaris, which means that their skin starts to become like scales.
Yeah, it's scaly skin, exactly.
Absolutely, and they molt. And I've seen entire patches, like a glove, actually taken off a person's hand and been there just like you were looking at a glove, just like a snake was molting.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
So the God question comes in, or the human psychological associations with what God is all about. When you're talking about the human brain and its antiquity and how it's rooted to that reptile that we were all a long time ago, and how that drives our subconscious autonomic functions of our body. And the constructs of the brain being three-part, you have the forebrain, the midbrain, and the hindbrain. This hindbrain belongs to the reptile. So if you're promoting something as evil all the time, what you're really doing is you're telling people to fear something that they have nagging them literally in the back of their mind as a form of self-identification, and they can't figure that out, and it becomes confusing to them.
A friend of mine wants to write a book based on the premise, John, that the devil was not evil, the devil was good, and that he was misunderstood. And I told him, I don't know if that would sell. You know, that's pretty revolutionary.
It's pretty revolutionary, but I can't remember the text offhand. I'm looking at my wife wondering if I've got my notes here, but there is actually a passage in the Bible in which God says, I created all things, I created evil. And some people just cannot get past that passage because they can't figure out why would God create something that supposedly is anti-God. Perhaps it's because you have a positive and a negative polarity about
us. You have to have that.
Right, and if we are like gods, like we were told in that garden, or gods talked amongst themselves and said, oh my gosh, look, they've become like one of us. Perhaps that duality is something that's inherited, it's a reflection of the above and below thing.
Now, these reptoids, if they're around, where might they be then? You believe most of them are within the planet, but North Pole, Antarctica, whereabouts?
Yeah, I think that we might find first fossil evidence down in Antarctica underneath the ice pack, maybe if we can get through the 3 or 4 miles of ice. Of course, that might just be melted away soon, just revealing all
true.
Kinds of things.
You don't have to worry about busting.
Right. Nobody has to take a bulldozer up there. That you can find, I believe that there's heavy concentrations of these creatures now in the American desert southwest, across the 37th parallel of the United States, which is almost the only continuous line running across the United States, which I also suspect there is a black operations or a black world tube shuttle program down there. If you go to my website at reptoids.com, I actually have a link on there where you can see the 1972 LA Times article interview with the lead physicist of the RAND Corporation, who talks about the construction of a hyperspeed tube shuttle under the United States, and said at that time it was economically and technologically feasible to move a person from coast to coast in 20 minutes at 10,000 miles an hour.
Oh, my God. And you think we have that?
I believe that we do. I believe that because the technology was so feasible
and not
so
for
economical,
us.
Why not hook up all our... Now, I'm treading on a dangerous area because we're at a state of war right now, so I got to be careful what I say. I don't, you know, the War Act is in effect now, so I don't want to give away too much information. I used to give away a lot more, let's put it that way. And because of the sensitivity of underground issues attached to security and national
Don't give us too much.
No. So I believe that there's an underground network across our nation of underground facilities that are beyond human imagination, that were started back in 1950s by the Truman administration. In 1951, we had 120 ships and about 10,000 men invade Thule in the northern subarctic, and this was to supposedly spy on Soviet detonations of atomic tests, when in fact, or a possible fact, it could be a follow-up to why James Doolittle was sent through the Exxon Corporation up to Norway and Sweden to look into the incidents of the Foo Fighters that were seen around that northern Arctic region.
Yep.
And that after we invaded Thule, the next year we had the sightings over the White House that many people forget.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there was a demonstration of air superiority.
Was that
over
52,
the
right?
1952,
yeah.
A demonstration of air superiority over the most sensitive air corridor in the world, or in the United States, if not the world. And then after that, in 1953, we had the development of the National Security Agency with the Intelligence Corps and Communications. We had a massive push of building underground structures that FEMA, since the 1980s, has been in charge of to actually prepare the United States for Armageddon. And if we're being told now, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm doing this as a patriot because I feel that we all have to be reminded that in the 1950s, when our parents or grandparents were being shown duck and cover drills because of any kind of a natural disaster, when we're being told now that that's right at our doorstep, I'm wondering why we're not being encouraged to prepare the very same way.
Well, we don't have those shelters anymore.
Well, a huge industry could be built on that, George.
Well, that's true.
You could be, you know, a huge industry could turn around and be built on that. And so...
Maybe it's like through the looking glass. It's not exactly as it appears.
It's not exactly as it appears. And nothing really is. I learned it some time ago from a good friend of mine that when you look at the UFO phenomenon or any of the things with ghosts and fairies or anything else like that, if you just turn it upside down and attach it to the underworld and what could be possibly happening underground, it all starts to make sense. It all starts to fit in. I believe that we've been misdirected into outer space to keep us from actually attaching ourselves to the true vision of really where these beings are, and that is underground. And that is more technologically achievable to find such creatures on our own planet rather than it is staring off into some space into an endless number of stars and planets.
Well, now, let's talk about their technology. Do you think these reptoids have UFO capability or flying saucer capability?
Yes, I do. You start thinking about how concentric ring circles and circles themselves with the ancients were many times identified with serpent worship, and the circular structures and the circular type of ritual centers that were built a long time ago were associated with the serpent symbol. And then you look at, from the ground and you look up to the saucer, a saucer shape, a classical saucer shape, of course you'd see a circle. And this could have been the same thing with circles within circles of Ezekiel. But I believe that they may have actually by now mastered, which we're starting to, actually manipulating atomic matter down to a plasma state and able to move things, shift things from one phase state to another. The UFO technology, my own personal take on this real quick, is the floating frog effect. When in Norway, these guys took an electromagnetic generator and put inanimate objects and even a frog into it, they were able to make the electron become unstable around the atomic nucleus. And when they did that, the frog or the inanimate objects lost their mass and floated in the air. And so if you have no mass, this means that if you could have a machine that does that, that loops in on itself and makes even the parts of the generator become plasma or out of phase, and those electrons are knocked off their orbit, that will also float. And if you lose your mass, then you have the ability to move from one location to another without inertia or without G-force, because they all take mass into consideration in those formulas. Once you get rid of mass, all of a sudden you recognize, hey, I'm just a plasma state, I'm just out of phase state, but I'm still together enough to be maybe like an astral body. And then all of a sudden, we can just zap our energies like through a line from one location to another, and we would hardly feel it, but we would be there. I have a feeling that might be the technological aspect.
Well, they're way ahead of us then, Sean.
Well, I think that we have it. And when you're talking about reptilian technology, you're talking about perhaps using brains that don't even think like mammals, so that what they would think about or how they would perceive technology would be different from ours because of the perceptions.
Go ahead.
Their technology may be perceived as being more advanced when really it may be equally as advanced but just working on a different set of dynamic principles of physics.
All right. When we come back, let's talk about that connection you said between Arizona and Mexico, and we'll also talk about Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End. This was a fascinating novel, by the way, that he published in 1953, and then another version was released in 2001 of all years. That deals with the transformation of humanity into part of an interplanetary hive mind. So we're going to get John Rhodes' take on that, because this book opens up with enormous alien spaceships appearing one day over Earth. It's a great, great story. And we'll just simply get your take on that, John, and we'll talk about some other things. At the top of the hour, we'll open up the phone line, so that'll be in about 30 minutes or so, where you can ask John Rhodes a question about some of the things we're talking about. Much more to go right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie along with John Rhodes. John, let's talk a little bit about the Arizona-Mexico tie-in with some of your work.
One of the things that I started to notice was that looking at the history of ancient England and the Celts over in that area of the world, the influence of the serpent image involved in their religion. You know, they talk about St. Patrick having gone to Ireland to rid them of snakes. Well, really, they didn't have a physical snake problem. They had a spiritual snake problem, which was that the locals there, the Celts, were very much into the serpent worship. Their symbolism is inundated with serpent worship. One of their great goddesses was half human, and the lower half was all serpent, and that was one of the big sacred secrets in the groves that were whispered around. So we have a concentration of area of England and Wales and Ireland, heavily dominated by Rh negative blood types today, having been descendants from those earlier peoples. But this area of Stonehenge and such, with the dominant theme of the serpent symbol in their religions, when you also look at the crop circles are happening there, we have the activity in Mexico City since 1991 during the solar eclipse, which again is another. These creatures, I don't believe, are making moves without trying to tell us something. And when they appeared during the solar eclipse, and since that time in 1991, more and more ships have been seen there. I've recently seen video of tens of, I would say about 100 ships or somewhere around there that were actually flying around Mexico in these formations.
100 of them?
Right. Wow. We've seen the Children of the Sun video, which shows like 30 or 40 of them in the sky, and apparently they're becoming more dominant and becoming more of a force down there than ever before. And when you think about that happening in Mexico, and then looking back at the mythology of ancient Mexico and how it was tied to the deity of Quetzalcoatl, which was the feathered serpent, here was somebody that came along who taught them supposedly how to look at the stars, all their mm-hmm. technology, agriculture. He was very, very, very wise being. And the mythology of Quetzalcoatl was that when he left, he said, I will be returning one day to return the empire, the Mayan empire, back to its former state.
By the way, don't get hit by a train. I hear a train in the background.
No, I'm not on the tracks. You know?
No, get back off that, John. You're doing well.
Putting the ear to the track of the UFO community. So when you start seeing this, again, heavy serpent symbolism down in that region of the world and this prophecy, and then you hear, you see this connection of what's happening down there. Now, I think it was 1994, 1995, I went down to Mexico City at the first international UFO conference, and I gave a speech there, and it was a very, very large audience at the medical center there, in which I told people that what we might be looking above Mexico City at are the descendants of the Maya, who may have been themselves castaways of some empire that had collapsed or had sank under the ocean, and that they may be coming out in force now in expectation of something coming here to arrive there. It's not U.S. craft. We don't have any military reason to be down there flying vehicles like that. They don't even have radars that have the same equivalent power or technology as do other nations that we might go to war with. So you have to wonder, why are they down there? Why were the British military personnel caught down there sneaking into the country and exploring their caves of Mexico without passports, which was quite an incident a couple of years ago. Do you remember that?
Yes, I sure do.
So why was the British military exploring the underground there? Bonnie Crystal, who is a friend of Art's and mine, she appeared on a television show with me, and the reason I had her brought on the show was because she was exploring a cave a number of years ago called La Cava del Arroyo, which means the cave of gold, with colleagues of hers, and they were down about four levels deep, four lengths of the rope deep, which is about 400 feet deep. They crossed a 75-foot underground river, and they came up upon a muddy bank, and inside, on the muddy bank were imprints of what she described as a bipedal lizard. It was not dragging its stomach. It was not dragging a tail. It had a little bit of a wide stance to it, but it was definitely walking on 2 feet underground.
Tell me about Lizard Man.
The Lizard Man. In 1988, in Bishopville, South Carolina, a young boy at about 17 years old named Christopher Davis was driving home one night, and he stopped to fix a flat tire along a place called Skateboard Swamp. And when he was fixing this tire out there, the poor boy, in the middle of the night, out of the field,
now.
He heard a rustling, and it was a hot night. And he just looked around, and he didn't think anything of it, and he went back to work. But then he heard it again, and from a field across the street, he looked up to see something that was like what he described as a lizard man running towards him at full gait.
And there was nobody else around,
And he put himself in the vehicle. He tried to drive down the street, and he said this thing reached out and jumped on the top of his car, trying to reach around to the front of the glass and pull on the antenna and stuff. And he got back home. He was so upset. He let it drop. His parents took him a number of hours to calm him down. Now, this was a very simple African-American family living out in the swamp areas. These people just don't, you know, they don't have any reason to start fictionalizing this stuff. And when that was reported to Sheriff Liston Truesdale out there, Liston went ahead and opened up an investigation into it because he had heard correlating reports being provided once the word got out from other people who had seen the same creature some weeks before. Since this event was so phenomenal that even Dan Rather was talking about it on the national news, and they were sending reporters out. It turned the place into an absolute zoo. We had people, people coming from out of town carrying shotguns through the swamp. We had individuals trying to dress up like Lizard Man in order to make it look like the whole thing was a hoax or something like that. Poor Liston was caught in a situation of saying, what do I do here? Because, you know, I've got people running around with shotguns,
yeah,
and people dressing up as lizard people. There's going to be some sort of an event here.
Yeah, someone's going to get blasted
away. Right, and he was caught in a very difficult predicament. After that settled down a bit, there were continuing reports that came in of sightings of this creature from individuals who had no interest whatsoever in any kind of publicity. And some of these people were very, very high up in the
community,
the local community, yeah, down there in South Carolina. As a matter of fact, there was a gentleman that was a full bird colonel, and he was getting ready to be promoted to brigadier general in the U.S. Army. His name was Cooper, and he was driving back from a Baptist wedding rehearsal, which, of course, you know, there's no drinking now, so we're not talking about people who are just coming back from a party drunk. And he was in the car with his wife. They were driving down the road. She was dozing next to him, and he said that he came upon a creature that was running in front of his car and looking behind him, almost like a dog. You know how some dogs, you'd pass by a neighborhood and they'd chase your tire?
Yeah.
And it's not that they're mad at you, and this could be the same for Christopher Davis's case. It doesn't necessarily mean that the creature was mad at them.
It just wants to chase something.
But perhaps its mate was roadkill.
Yeah, yeah.
And perhaps it had something about vehicles, because in one other incident out there, there was a vehicle that was mauled outside somebody's house.
It just tore it apart?
Right, and it looks like a small animal was being hunted, and it may have tried to hide in the engine compartment of one of the large, older model cars, and something had literally reached around this vehicle and tore the siding off it, around the wheel,
yeah,
well, there's that strip of metal, and it had torn it off. Liston said when he got out there to look at it, he said, you know, myself and my deputy, he says, we pulled on that thing, and I mean, we put our feet up against the car and pulled on it. He said, we couldn't move that thing, so whatever did it had a tremendous amount of strength, and there were wires pulled out from the car. So when you're talking about creatures that may look aggressive in a situation, it doesn't we can't immediately assume this is because we're frightened that we're the victim. It may, in these two cases, it looks like something out there had an issue with cars. So when you start hearing about reports like that coming in from a man that's about to be promoted to brigadier general who just died this last year, and we have families. I mean, there's a case in which a woman was driving with her two children in the car, and they were laughing about the Lizard Man account. And they'd just come back from Baskin-Robbins, and they're driving along the same road, and because they hit that one area where it's historically known in that area as being the spot, they started laughing about it, and no sooner had they laughed about it when suddenly something jumped out in front of their car.
They didn't laugh anymore.
No, they came to a screeching halt, and apparently when these people said they looked out, she looked to the passenger side of the window where her daughter was, and she said all she could see was the width of this creature standing there, and it looked like it had fur. And when she stepped on it, and when the kids were looking back, they were commenting what it looked like, and she stopped the car, turned around and looked, and it was affirmed what her kids were saying was true, and they got the hell out of there. And, of course, all the reports were taken. And when you're seeing something, this is the whole thing down there. There were these mixed reports of this creature had hair, but we have to understand that we could be, just like mammals, there could be some advanced reptiles out there that may be flying ships around, but there could be some very wild ones as well.
Some plants that might have been stuck on them.
Right, or skins of animals used as disguise or even to keep warm.
Lizard man, Mothman, maybe one of the same?
Mothman, in my estimation, when I read, you know, John Keel's great reports on it, and hearing about the reptoids, especially the Draco that have been seen, if something was up in the air and the Draco did have wings, if its neck was drooped down as it was looking down at people and it had red glowing eyes, in the dark it would appear that the red glowing eyes are in the middle of its chest. It's very anomalous and unusual to hear about these reports of the Mothman, and they always place these eyes in the middle of the chest. Perhaps this creature was just looking down, and the reflective eyes, like off a cat, were catching it, and this is what they were seeing. The reptilian contacts, when people have them, they often tend to have highly psychic events afterwards, and with Keel's reports down with Mothman events, there was a large amount of psychic activity taking place there, with the bridge and, of course, the deaths of all those people.
Years ago, I interviewed a woman by the name of Pamela Stonebrook, who claims she's a musician, and she claims that she has had an ongoing love affair with a reptilian. Now, is she nuts, or what's going on?
I hear this a lot, and the only thing I can say is the reason that this has been promoted so much in recent years is because of sexationalization. In other words, they sexationalize it. When there's some titillating type of thing, excuse the pun, you know, involved in these reports, people are more entertained by it. So, of course, there's more promotion of it. I do know that when there's a number of years ago, these guys came out with this device where they could stimulate a woman's spine at the base of her spine and give her an orgasm just with vibration and frequency. And knowing this and knowing that there's a connection to the lower base of the spine, and the lower base of the spine is the lower chakra of the kundalini, when you have a being coming next to you like a tuning fork, if it's generating its atoms and molecules at a higher rate just by sympathetic resonance, which means like you strike a tuning fork and draw it close to another one and the other one starts to resonate as well, when these creatures come within our vicinity, our atomic vibration, we become illuminated. Literally, we start releasing light, and we have a psychic activity. But as the tuning fork dulls down, the psychic activity starts to diminish with time.
Now, these abduction cases that so many people have talked about, where they think they see grays, are they also seeing these reptoids there?
The grays are disappearing into the shadows more and more now, and the reptoids are revealing their presence.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to, let me just finish this, when it comes to these people talking about sexual encounters with these beings, if you were sleeping in the middle of the night and you were a woman and something came within your presence into your room and it's vibrating at a higher rate, if your lower chakra starts getting generated, when you're asleep and in a hypnagogic state, you're immediately thinking a sexual thing because you're being stimulated in that way because your chakra, your lower chakra, is starting to light up.
It's almost like what happens in sleep paralysis, I guess.
Right. And in this case, because there's a sexual edge to it, where a sexual sensation of arousal being held, you believe that this person is actually penetrating.
So she may believe that this is really happening to her.
No, it could have really happened. And then afterwards, subsequent events either really did happen, or like in some of the captions of the images I put on your site over there, it's difficult for people to tell the real event from the not real event, because usually after an encounter with these creatures, it stimulates them to be dreaming things. You know, the symbol of the serpent in the human mind in Jung psychiatry has always been one of stimulation of transformation. And when you have an event like that takes place, it's the natural image to start permeating from your hindbrain to your forebrain as trying to give a message of something. And the message is something may have happened, and also that reptilian is that reptilian that you're afraid of may be part of your own spiritual being as well. So there's the crossover.
You had mentioned earlier Childhood's End, which is the novel by Arthur C. Clarke, and I just mentioned a little bit about what that is. Well, what's the tie-in here with that?
Well, in 1952, we had the demonstration of air superiority over the White House. 1953, we had the mass migration of U.S. military industrial corporate industries into the underground. We also had, like I said, the building of the NSA and such. But right at that time, 1953, within a year, Arthur C. Clarke writes the book Child's Hood's End, which talks about reptilian aliens, reptoids, reptilian humanoids. That's the correct term for these creatures. Reptilian could be anything. Even an alligator is a reptilian, but you have to be specific and say reptilian humanoid. He postulates in this book that these reptilian humanoids descended upon Earth, and, of course, Earth went into the stagnation after their presence. And it basically reflects on how a higher culture influences a lower culture, like anthropologists find out when they see how we interact with lesser, you know, intelligent peoples in deep Africa and stuff for the first time. The interesting thing about this is that if you read the front of Arthur C. Clarke's book, he makes the point out of writing in it, the opinions offered in this book are not those of the author. And I found that really fascinating.
That is interesting, because he never does that.
Write that. It doesn't make sense why he would write such a thing. Basically saying that these ideas and opinions aren't mine, but I'm writing them. So it makes you wonder, is it possible that a lot of what we see in the media now is actually mixed with a lot of the truth, and that's the way to desensitize us to the possible event in the future? Because then, psychologically, we've already been there, done that, because we saw a movie.
That's fascinating all by itself.
Now, the connection, you were going to ask me about the connections between Arizona, Mexico, and England. Well, we've tied in, possibly, England and Mexico with the activity. But now the tie-in between Arizona and Mexico is this. A number of years ago, and this is an entirely different show, we could do it at a different time, I started investigating this thing about this lost city in the Grand Canyon that the Smithsonian Institution found in 1909. During my investigation of it, and it's 15 years now that I've been studying it, when you look into the cultures of the Hopi Indians, they refer back to a time in which there were two beings that take them underground cyclically during times of great devastation, and they are the Ant people. Now, you could say that's a gray. Large head,
good.
Large eyes, small limbs, lives underground. And then they had what they call their elder brothers, the snake people. And when I heard about this thing being found in the Grand Canyon, and I've actually... I even wrote a letter to the Smithsonian Institution asking questions, and they just blatantly sent me back a letter that they were caught lying even in their own letter to me, which was absolutely ridiculous. When you start looking at a mythology of a large underground city in the Grand Canyon, big enough for 50,000 people to live in, that was about 1,400 feet off the current level of the river, which in geological time, because of the erosion rate, would place it back at least 1.5 million years.
Hold it right there, John. We'll pick you right up when we come back.